Having safe sex inside prison is a lot more complicated than you might think. This was what members of a queer prisoner support group in Montreal discovered when they tried to create a program advocating safe sex on the inside. Liam Michaud O'Grady and Julia de Montigny offer a workshop called You Improvise to Survive. We've reached them in Montreal. Hello to you both.
Hey there.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Liam, can you first explain why is it so hard for prisoners to access safe sex inside prison?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the answer to the question in a large part depends on the context, too, of where you're talking about. So, of course, the situation varies a lot from the U.S. to Canada and also from province to province and from individual prison to individual prison, but basically, I think there's like a range of, I'd say there's definitely like a really wide range of experiences in terms of access to safer sex materials, both information and specific kinds of resources like condoms, ranging from individual prison administrations just claiming that it's not necessary or that it's just not a priority to kind of more insidious or structural barriers like condoms being rationed if they are. So, for instance, if there is specific policy that exists that permits condom access for prisoners, there's often a lot of structural barriers in place. Nonetheless, like needing to ask for condoms from a specific healthcare from a nurse at the prison or. Access to condoms requiring you incriminating yourself in different ways. So, for instance, if sexual activity is illegal at your prison, which it is almost across the board in prisons across the U.S. and Canada, and access to condoms requires you asking for them, then people are put in situations all the time where they're directly incriminating themselves or outing themselves as being gay or queer or trans or as being sexually active. Or outing themselves as being HIV positive in certain cases. So there's all sorts of barriers, and it's kind of hard to touch on just one or two of them without kind of talking about all of them at the same time.
Julia, I think it seems strange that there would be these barriers because I think most of us don't even, you know, maybe even think about prisoners really having sex, but I think most of us would assume that condoms are available and that they would be widely available. And, you know, it seems strange that it would be a problem to have to ask for that. So, what do you hear from these prisoners about that experience?
About whether or not they have access?
About the difficulties of asking for condoms or what do they tell you about that?
In the You Improvise to Survive anthology that we've put together as a collective, we get a bunch of different kinds of responses to that question. I think, by and large, most people respond that it's just not really... it's just not really a question that people just don't really ask for them very often because it's just known that it's not very available. And so what a lot of people respond is by talking about like alternatives to that and what safer sex actually might mean to them. So a lot of that's just like for some of them it's like understanding risk or just deciding to, you know, take some of those risks.
Liam, when did you realize that a workshop was needed to talk about these issues?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of hard to say because, like Julia was just mentioning, it emerged out of a collective, the Prisoner Correspondence Project that's been doing this work for a couple of years now, and so it was really, and the entire project is the collective is organized specifically around coordinating pen pal relationships. So each of us have someone inside right now who we're corresponding with and who we've kind of been developing friendships with over the course of the past couple of years. So I think in a lot of ways the need for the workshop emerged out of those personal connections and the stuff that we were hearing both from our individual friends and pen pals who we were in kind of consistent touch with, as well as from the folks we are hearing from through the project more broadly, who are requesting resources, who are submitting things for the newsletter. So I think that was definitely a kind of overwhelming request in terms of resource requests from folks on the inside, was not just access to safer sex materials, but safer sex materials that were relevant to the realities that they're facing. So for instance, you'll see we were finding that a lot of prison resources aimed at prisoners did not acknowledge the reality of sex, did not acknowledge the reality of desire and pleasure within the prison system. Similarly, a lot of the safer sex resources that we had access to or that we know of were assumed condom access, and were not directed either at prisoners or just assumed uninhibited condom access for whatever reason. So we were finding that both of these resources were kind of enacting an erasure on a certain level. And so I guess it was really in response to that, to what we saw and what people were experiencing actively as erasure, that we, I guess, saw the need for the creation of new resources and the creation of a workshop series specifically that addressed these issues.
And are all the pen pals on the inside that you correspond with, are they all lesbian or gay or queer or bi?
Yeah, they're all gay or queer or trans identified, and there's definitely a range in terms of how folks identify, and it also gets really complicated because a lot of folks are also not out at their prison or out to varying degrees, and so it creates all sorts of issues around safety as well that can obviously be pretty tricky in coordinating something like this. So to answer your question, the workshop itself, the workshop series itself, basically began as a venue to seek out submissions, anecdotes, experiences, and try to assess the need on the part of our inside pen pals. And so the workshop series, all of the submissions that we gathered, and this is what Julia is referring to when she mentioned You and Professor Survive, are being called together in an anthology, and the workshop series as well as the submissions themselves are the basis, are the kind of, I guess, research basis for the actual Safer Sex pamphlet series that we'll be putting out starting this fall.
Now, you mentioned that this workshop came out of need from the inside for information about getting access to safe sex or how information about how to practice safe sex. But where were you able to find that information for them, or how did you go about doing that research, Julia?
Well, funnily enough, I feel like Liam is better equipped to actually answer that question.
Sure.
Yeah, maybe I can start, and you can kind of pick up in a minute, but. I guess very different collective members, those of us on the core collective, have kind of like come from a bunch of different areas and experiences in terms of health and prevention experience. And so to an extent we were drawing upon our own knowledge base, at least initially, and then we were developing these resources in collaboration with a number of community organizations on the outside. So different AIDS service organizations and harm reduction kind of foundations or groups in and around the city, in and around Montreal, who were great enough to meet with us and kind of workshop the draft that we put together. And we also have a kind of informal small committee of inside folks with whom we're workshopping these resources as well. And so that that health knowledge, the specific kinds of safer sex health knowledge, kind of, I guess, emerged pretty organically, both through the experiences and anecdotes that people were sharing with us in terms of their submissions and contributions to the series, to an extent from our own personal knowledge base, and to an extent as well from the kind of like expertise of kind of allied organizations. But that being said, there's definitely a lot of overlap too between specific kinds of sexual health knowledges and people's own experiences, say, of the prison system or of anti-queer violence at the site of the prison system or of histories of incarceration. And so what we found as well was that all of these different areas that we before experienced as quite discrete or quite distinct in different ways were starting to see all of these links and overlaps emerge. And so in that regard, it really directed the resource series to, I guess, to kind of cover that scope and to attend to the range of those realities and those experiences.
And in these workshops, you read out the thoughts and responses from the prisoners that you correspond with. What have they told you, or do you have examples of what they've written?
I could read a few.
Sure, that would be great.
Okay. So I picked out a couple that sort of highlight some of the big issues. The first one's from someone named J.A. Brown, and it says, "In terms of the issue of allowing and issuing condoms, by not providing them, it doesn't discourage sexual behavior and promiscuity, but rather only threatens to give a worldwide epidemic a lot more momentum." So it's one little thought. Another submission from Matt Jones, who's actually Liam's pen pal in Oregon. I had to say this. "I had a boyfriend here in prison for a couple of months. Here in prison, or at least this prison, there's no such thing as safe sex. It's against the rules. So the only way that I found to be safe is to have an AIDS and hepatitis test. You can show your partner your results. So when I met Steven, I asked to see his AIDS and hep test results and saw that they were current and negative, so we ended up fucking like wild rabbits in heat. I've heard of guys using sandwich bags and plastic wrap as condoms. As for lube, we've discovered baby oil works the best." Maybe I'll read the a submission by Amazon, whose quote actually has the title of our workshop in it. So, "I can't really offer advice about safe sex. I don't practice it. I practice being careful, in my own way. It doesn't involve the use of things like plastic and rubber. Mostly, I just avoid body fluids, which is the main way of transmission. That's tricky, but hey, it's the life. You improvise to survive. That's all I can offer." Yeah. So does that help a little bit?
Yeah. Were you, those are pretty, diverse comments in terms of their points of view and where they're coming from and their experiences. Were you surprised, or what struck you when you were kind of receiving all these responses from people?
Well, I guess I'm not really so much as surprised. That doesn't mean that I don't feel like a little bit upset by them sometimes, or feel that they're really intense statements. But I think that sort of reflects just like how used to hearing about it we become when you're in contact with a pen pal on the inside. But also, I think it sort of just reflects just how widespread these realities are, because I think to a certain extent, people on the outside, who are part of LGBTQ communities, can really identify with some of these statements sometimes. I also, maybe another way of thinking that how I feel about this, I guess I feel kind of, when I first heard the statements, I felt really honored and that people were willing to just articulate their resistance to the kind of violence, like even if it's sort of like a more passive, like J.A. Brown's, just sort of acknowledging that it's this this huge structural violence against like a broader community at large, or if it's just sort of like strategic examples of survival that Matt offered, for example. I felt like really inspired by the strategies that people have developed, and Liam, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just reiterate what you just said, actually, and just I think my reaction to the statements was yeah, not necessarily one of surprise, because there's, I think, a certain familiarity. I think a lot of us had grown to kind of hearing about this, but was just kind of being a bit floored by I guess just the acknowledgement of how widespread these realities are. And I think, yeah, definitely being inspired by the strategies that people have forged in the face of, I think, some pretty stark instances of anti-queer and anti-trans violence that I think in a lot of ways like inhibit people's abilities to survive. And so hearing people's, I think really honest honest articulation of their experiences was really, was just really inspiring for me. And I think also what was kind of doubly inspiring was the risk that people took in terms of sending in these submissions, you know, despite in some cases not being out as gay or as trans, and in some cases not being out as being HIV positive, despite the risks that carries in terms of administrative retaliation, in terms of mailroom censorship, in terms of different administrators of the prisons finding out. I think it was also a humbling experience for those of us working in the collective to receive them and acknowledge that as well.
Because do the administrators actually read through all the mail that these prisoners send out?
I think it's hard to say in terms of policy level what exact practice is, where exact practice is at, but that's definitely always a risk, right? So the reality, I suppose, is that ingoing mail tends to be screened or censored with more regularity than outgoing mail, but that being said, there's always a risk. So especially if you happen to be a prisoner who's under a particular surveillance for one reason or another, or under some kind of in solitary or under some kind of behavioral assessment. I've heard of different experiences of people's mail being screened pretty regularly or censored or seized or delayed or what have you.
So I know you take this workshop to various queer prisoner support groups or AIDS education groups on the outside, but how do you get this information inside?
That's a really good question, because I think that's it's definitely something we have to be creative with, creative about, and there's different, because of the different structural barriers that exist, like we were just talking about, it can make that obviously really difficult. The resource series itself is one way of kind of creating a loop whereby a lot of these experiences and anecdotes and stories are shared again inside in different form. We're also working on this anthology as well, which will then be a part of our resource library of pamphlets and information and books and resources that we publish in our newsletter and everyone is able to request. Those are just two kind of small examples of how we hope to get this information inside. I think the other thing too, and this is maybe an anecdote that we've shared a couple of times that kind of came about at the very beginning, in the early days of the project, but it's just acknowledging the kinds of the networks that already exist and that have existed in prisons for a long time. And when I say networks, I'm referring specifically to kind of informal networks of kind of survival and mutual support among incarcerated communities. And so what we found is that we would send in a single pamphlet, a single resource to one person who is incarcerated at one institution, and then we'd get a letter months later from that same person saying, "Hey, would you mind sending us another pamphlet that you sent a couple months ago, because it's traveled so many hands that the edges of the paper have become worn, and it's passed through so many hands that the print, the typeset on the edge of the paper has rubbed off, and so you can't read it in places." And it was just moments like this that made us realize that, you know, that this information, I suppose, is once we send it in, it's being transmitted and it's being circulated in all sorts of different ways as well, through these networks that we're not even you know, that we only have, that we're not even a part of, really. So so I think that's another way that I think that it is less obvious or less explicit, or we don't always remember that at first, or we don't always think about that at first, but it's also, yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that those networks do exist, and that's another, I think, a really essential tool in terms of prevention work, in terms of work supporting prisoners as well.
That's really amazing. What do they tell you about, I guess, how did they react when you asked them to kind of give input into these workshops and give their experiences? How did your pen pals feel about that? Or did they tell you?
I don't know. Julie, do you have anything to say to that?
Well, my pen pal didn't contribute anything to the project specifically, though I would say that overall, reading other statements that other people have made, or other people on the inside have made about submitting or being part of it, I mean, generally the attitude is people feel pretty positive, because I think overall, in both queer communities and in, like, prison justice worlds, the voices of people who are inside are very rarely actually heard. So I think it feels pretty validating in lots of ways. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I think I, from at least a handful of people, I got the sense, and this is, you know, I think it's also important to note that where we, in terms of these submissions and these workshops and this anthology and this series, it's, we're also working with a select group of people, right? So in no ways, like, can we necessarily take this to be, like, representative of all incarcerated gay and queer and trans people, right? But in terms of at least what we've seen, I would also say that the impression that I've got is one of kind of, like, oh, finally, you know? Like, it's been 5 years, or in one case someone was like, it's been 10 years since I've been able to talk about this openly in any kind of way. And so there's definitely, I think, for at least some people, a sense of relief and a sense of relief at finally being able to have access to some kind of community or some kind of venue or some kind of